Section 8 of Orlando by Virginia Woolf. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose, as long as Legamus is credited. Chapter 3, Part 2. The sound of the trumpets died away, and Orlando stood stark naked. No human being, since the world began, has ever looked more ravishing. His form combined in one the strength of a man and a woman's grace. As he stood there, the silver trumpets prolonged their note, as if reluctant to leave the lovely sight which their blast had called forth. And chastity, purity, and modesty, inspired no doubt by curiosity, peeped in at the door, and threw a garment like a towel at the naked form, which, unfortunately, fell short by several inches. Orlando looked himself up and down in a long looking-glass, without showing any signs of discomposure, and went, presumably, to his bath. We may take advantage of this pause in the narrative to make certain statements. Orlando had become a woman, there is no denying it. But in every other respect, Orlando remained precisely as he had been. The change of sex, although it altered their future, did nothing whatever to alter their identity. Their faces remained, as their portraits prove, practically the same. His memory, but in future we must, for convention's sake, say her for his, and she for he. Her memory, then, went back through all the events of her past life without encountering any obstacle. Some slight haziness there may have been, as if a few dark drops had fallen into the clear pool of memory. Certain things had become a little dimmed, but that was all. The change seemed to have been accomplished painlessly and completely, and in such a way that Orlando herself showed no surprise at it. Many people, taking this into account, and holding that such a change of sex is against nature, have been at great pains to prove, one, that Orlando had always been a woman, two, that Orlando is at this moment a man. Let biologists and psychologists determine. It is enough for us to state the simple fact. Orlando was a man till the age of 30, when he became a woman, and has remained so ever since. But let other pens treat of sex and sexuality. We quit such odious subjects as soon as we can. Orlando had now washed and dressed herself in those Turkish coats and trousers which can be worn indifferently by either sex, and was forced to consider her position. That it was precarious and embarrassing in the extreme must be the first thought of every reader who has followed her story with sympathy. Young, noble, beautiful, she had woken to find herself in a position than which we can conceive none more delicate for a young lady of rank. We should not have blamed her had she rung the bell, screamed, or fainted. But Orlando showed no such signs of perturbation. All her actions were deliberate in the extreme, and might indeed have been thought to show tokens of premeditation. First, she carefully examined the papers on the table, took such as seemed to be written in poetry, and secreted them in her bosom. Next, she called her Salucci hound, which had never left her bed all these days, though half famished with hunger, fed and combed him, then stuck a pair of pistols in her belt, finally wound about her person several strings of emeralds and pearls of the finest orient which had formed part of her ambassadorial wardrobe. This done, she leant out of the window, gave one low whistle, and descended the shattered and blood-stained staircase, now strewn with the litter of waste-paper baskets, treaties, dispatches, seals, sealing-wax, etc., and so entered the courtyard. There, in the shadow of a giant fig-tree, waited an old gypsy on a donkey. He led another by the bridle. Orlando swung her leg over it, and thus, attended by a lean dog, riding a donkey, in company of a gypsy, the ambassador of Great Britain at the court of the Sultan, left Constantinople. They rode for several days and nights, and met with a variety of adventures, some at the hands of men, some at the hands of nature, in all of which Orlando acquitted herself with courage. Within a week they reached the high ground outside Brusa, which was then the chief camping ground of the gypsy tribe to which Orlando had allied herself. Often she had looked at those mountains from her balcony at the embassy, often had longed to be there, and to find oneself where one has longed to be always, to a reflective mind, gives food for thought. For some time, however, she was too well pleased with the change to spoil it by thinking. The pleasure of having no documents to seal or sign, no flourishes to make, no calls to pay, was enough. The gypsies followed the grass. When it was grazed down, on they moved again. She washed in streams if she washed at all. No boxes, red, blue, or green, were presented to her. There was not a key, let alone a golden key, in the whole camp. As for visiting, the word was unknown. She milked the goats. She collected brushwood. She stole a hen's egg now and then, but always put a coin or a pearl in place of it. She herded cattle. She stripped vines. She trod the grape. She filled the goat skin and drank from it. And when she remembered how, at about this time of day, she should have been making the motions of drinking and smoking over an empty coffee cup and a pipe which lacked tobacco, she laughed aloud, cut herself another hunch of bread, and begged for a puff from old Rustum's pipe, filled though it was with cow dung. The gypsies, with whom it is obvious that she must have been in secret communication before the revolution, seemed to have looked upon her as one of themselves, which is always the highest compliment a people can pay, and her dark hair and dark complexion bore out the belief that she was, by birth, one of them, and had been snatched by an English duke from a nut-tree when she was a baby, and taken to that barbarous land where people live in houses because they are too feeble and diseased to stand the open air. Thus, though in many ways inferior to them, they were willing to help her to become more like them, taught her their arts of cheese-making and basket-weaving, their science of stealing and bird-snaring, and were even prepared to consider letting her marry among them. But Orlando had contracted in England some of the customs, or diseases, whatever you choose to consider them, which cannot, it seems, be expelled. One evening, when they were all sitting round the campfire, and the sunset was blazing over the Thessalian hills, Orlando exclaimed, "How good to eat!" The gypsies have no word for beautiful. This is the nearest. All the young men and women burst out laughing uproariously. The sky, good to eat indeed! The elders, however, who had seen more of foreigners than they had, became suspicious. They noticed that Orlando often sat for whole hours doing nothing whatever, except look here and then there. They would come upon her on some hilltop, staring straight in front of her, no matter whether the goats were grazing or straying. They began to suspect that she had other beliefs than their own, and the older men and women thought it probable that she had fallen into the clutches of the vilest and cruelest among all the gods, which is nature. Nor were they far wrong. The English disease, a love of nature, was inborn in her, and here, where nature was so much larger and more powerful than in England, she fell into its hands as she had never done before. The malady is too well known, and has been, alas, too well described, to need describing afresh, save very briefly. There were mountains, there were valleys, there were streams. She climbed the mountains, roamed the valleys, sat on the banks of the streams. She likened the hills to ramparts, to the breasts of doves and the flanks of kine. She compared the flowers to enamel, and the turf to turkey rugs worn thin. Trees were withered hags, and sheep were grey boulders. Everything, in fact, was something else. She found the tarn on the mountain top, and almost threw herself in to seek the wisdom she thought lay hid there. And when, from the mountain top, she beheld far off, across the sea of Marmora, the plains of Greece, and made out, her eyes were admirable, the Acropolis, with a white streak or two which must, she thought, be the Parthenon, her soul expanded with her eyeballs, and she prayed that she might share the majesty of the hills, know the serenity of the plains, etc., etc., as all such believers do. Then, looking down, The red hyacinth, the purple iris, wrought her to cry out in ecstasy at the goodness, the beauty of nature. Raising her eyes again, she beheld the eagle soaring, and imagined its raptures and made them her own. Returning home, she saluted each star, each peak, and each watch-fire, as if they signalled to her alone. And at last, when she flung herself upon her mat in the gypsy's tent, she could not help bursting out again, "How good to eat! How good to eat!" For it is a curious fact that, though human beings have such imperfect means of communication that they can only say "good to eat" when they mean "beautiful," and the other way about, they will yet endure ridicule and misunderstanding rather than keep any experience to themselves. All the young gypsies laughed. But Rustum El Sadi, the old man who had brought Orlando out of Constantinople on his donkey, sat silent. He had a nose like a scimitar. His cheeks were furrowed as if from the age-long descent of iron hail. He was brown and keen-eyed, and as he sat tugging at his hookah, he observed Orlando narrowly. He had the deepest suspicion that her god was nature. One day he found her in tears. Interpreting this to mean that her god had punished her, he told her that he was not surprised. He showed her the fingers of his left hand, withered by the frost. He showed her his right foot, crushed where a rock had fallen. This, he said, was what her god did to men. When she said, "But so beautiful," using the English word, he shook his head, and when she repeated it he was angry. He saw that she did not believe what he believed, and that was enough, wise and ancient as he was, to enrage him. This difference of opinion disturbed Orlando, who had been perfectly happy until now. She began to think, was nature beautiful or cruel? Then she asked herself what this beauty was, whether it was in things themselves or only in herself. So she went on to the nature of reality, which led her to truth, which in its turn led to love, friendship, poetry, as in the days on the high mound at home, which meditations, since she could impart no word of them, made her long, as she had never longed before, for pen and ink. "Oh, if only I could write!" she cried, for she had the odd conceit of those who write, that words written are shared. She had no ink, and but little paper. But she made ink from berries and wine, and finding a few margins and blank spaces in the manuscript of The Oak Tree, managed, by writing a kind of shorthand, to describe the scenery in a long, blank-verse poem, and to carry on a dialogue with herself about this beauty and truth concisely enough. This kept her extremely happy for hours on end, but the gypsies became suspicious. First, they noticed that she was less adept than before at milking and cheese-making. Next, she often hesitated before replying, and once a gypsy boy who had been asleep woke in a terror, feeling her eyes upon him. Sometimes this constraint would be felt by the whole tribe, numbering some dozens of grown men and women. It sprang from the sense they had, and their senses are very sharp and much in advance of their vocabulary, that whatever they were doing crumbled like ashes in their hands. An old woman making a basket, a boy skinning a sheep, would be singing or crooning contentedly at their work, when Orlando would come into the camp, fling herself down by the fire and gaze into the flames. She need not even look at them, and yet they felt, "Here is someone who doubts." We make a rough and ready translation from the gypsy language. "Here is someone who does not do the thing for the sake of doing, nor looks for looking's sake. Here is someone who believes neither in sheepskin nor basket, but sees..." Here they looked apprehensively about the tent. "Something else." Then a vague but most unpleasant feeling would begin to work in the boy and in the old woman. They broke their withies. They cut their fingers. A great rage filled them. They wished Orlando would leave the tent and never come near them again. Yet she was of a cheerful and willing disposition, they owned, and one of her pearls was enough to buy the finest herd of goats in Brusa. Slowly she began to feel that there was some difference between her and the gypsies, which made her hesitate sometimes to marry and settle down among them for ever. At first she tried to account for it by saying that she came of an ancient and civilized race, whereas these gypsies were an ignorant people, not much better than savages. One night, when they were questioning her about England, she could not help with some pride describing the house where she was born, how it had 365 bedrooms, and had been in the possession of her family for 400 or 500 years. Her ancestors were earls, or even dukes, she added. At this she noticed again that the gypsies were uneasy, but not angry as before when she had praised the beauty of nature. Now they were courteous, but concerned, as people of fine breeding are, when a stranger has been made to reveal his low birth or poverty. Rustum followed her out of the tent alone, and said that she need not mind if her father were a duke, and possessed all the bedrooms and furniture that she described. They would none of them think the worse of her for that. Then she was seized with a shame that she had never felt before. It was clear that Rustum and the other gypsies thought a descent of 400 or 500 years only the meanest possible. Their own families went back at least 2,000 or 3,000 years. To the gypsy whose ancestors had built the pyramids centuries before Christ was born, the genealogy of Howards and Plantagenets was no better and no worse than that of the Smiths and the Joneses. Both were negligible. Moreover, where the shepherd boy had a lineage of such antiquity, there was nothing specially memorable or desirable in ancient birth. Vagabonds and beggars all shared it. And then, though he was too courteous to speak openly, it was clear that the gypsy thought that there was no more vulgar ambition than to possess bedrooms by the hundred. They were on top of a hill as they spoke. It was night. The mountains rose around them. When the whole earth is ours. Looked at from the gypsy point of view, a duke, Orlando understood, was nothing but a profiteer or robber who snatched land and money from people who rated these things of little worth, and could think of nothing better to do than build 365 bedrooms, when one was enough, and none was even better than one. She could not deny that her ancestors had accumulated field after field, house after house, honour after honour. Yet had none of them been saints or heroes, or great benefactors of the human race. Nor could she counter the argument. Rustum was too much of a gentleman to press it, but she understood that any man who did now what her ancestors had done 300 or 400 years ago would be denounced, and by her own family most loudly, for a vulgar upstart, an adventurer, a nouveau riche. She sought to answer such arguments by the familiar, if oblique, method of finding the gypsy life itself rude and barbarous, and so, in a short time, much bad blood was bred between them. Indeed, such differences of opinion are enough to cause bloodshed and revolution. Towns have been sacked for less, and 1,000,000 martyrs have suffered at the stake, rather than yield an inch upon any of the points here debated. No passion is stronger in the breast of man than the desire to make others believe as he believes. Nothing so cuts at the root of his happiness and fills him with rage as the sense that another rates low what he prizes high. Whigs and Tories, Liberal Party and Labour Party, for what do they battle except their own prestige? It is not love of truth, but desire to prevail, that sets quarter against quarter, and makes parish desire the downfall of parish. Each seeks peace of mind and subserviency, rather than the triumph of truth and the exaltation of virtue. But these moralities belong, and should be left to, the historian, since they are as dull as ditch-water. 476 bedrooms mean nothing to them, sighed Orlando. She prefers a sunset to a flock of goats, said the gypsies. What was to be done, Orlando could not think. To leave the gypsies and become once more an ambassador seemed to her intolerable. But it was equally impossible to remain forever where there was neither ink nor writing-paper, neither reverence for the Talbots nor respect for a multiplicity of bedrooms. So she was thinking, one fine morning, on the slopes of Mount Athos, when minding her goats. And then nature, in whom she trusted, either played her a trick or worked a miracle. Again, opinions differ too much for it to be possible to say which. Orlando was gazing rather disconsolately at the steep hillside in front of her. It was now midsummer, and if we must compare the landscape to anything, it would have been to a dry bone, to a sheep's skeleton, to a gigantic skull picked white by a thousand vultures. The heat was intense, and the little fig tree under which Orlando lay only served to print patterns of fig leaves upon her light burnoose. Suddenly a shadow, though there was nothing to cast a shadow, appeared on the bald mountainside opposite. It deepened quickly, and soon a green hollow showed where there had been barren rock before. As she looked, the hollow deepened and widened, and a great park-like space opened in the flank of the hill. Within, she could see an undulating and grassy lawn. She could see oak trees dotted here and there. She could see the thrushes hopping among the branches. She could see the deer stepping delicately from shade to shade, and could even hear the hum of insects and the gentle sighs and shivers of a summer's day in England. After she had gazed entranced for some time, snow began falling. Soon the whole landscape was covered, and marked with violet shadows instead of yellow sunlight. Now she saw heavy carts coming along the roads, laden with tree trunks, which they were taking, she knew, to be sawn for firewood. And then appeared the roofs and belfries and towers and courtyards of her own home. The snow was falling steadily, and she could now hear the slither and flop which it made as it slid down the roof and fell to the ground. The smoke went up from a thousand chimneys. All was so clear and minute that she could see a door pecking for worms in the snow. Then, gradually, the violet shades deepened and closed over the carts and the lawns and the great house itself. All was swallowed up. Now there was nothing left of the grassy hollow, and instead of the green lawns was only the blazing hillside, which a thousand vultures seemed to have picked bare. At this she burst into a passion of tears, and striding back to the gypsies' camp, told them that she must sail for England the very next day. It was happy for her that she did so. Already the young men had plotted her death. Honour, they said, demanded it, for she did not think as they did. Yet they would have been sorry to cut her throat, and welcomed the news of her departure. An English merchant ship, as luck would have it, was already under sail in the harbour about to return to England, and Orlando, by breaking off another pearl from her necklace, not only paid her passage, but had some banknotes left over in her wallet. These she would have liked to present to the gypsies, but they despised wealth, she knew, and she had to content herself with embraces which on her part were sincere. End of section 8.